this week's Sedra, there is the Parsha of the Eishes Yifastor. I really don't want to go into explaining the whole concept behind it, so I want to focus in on one side point that's really relevant to all of us. But let me just explain what it is in brief. And if there's time in the end, I will take questions as to understanding what it's all about. Eishes Yifastor is the following. You go out to war, in a war that is not one of the wars where you have to exterminate everyone, men, women, and children, like the Amalek or the seven nations in Canaan, but a regular war, and you take a captive. A man captures a non-Jewish woman, and he brings her home, and he obviously can't marry her, she's not Jewish. And she goes through a, not forced, but not a real conversion. A real conversion, halachically, but not what a normal conversion would be. It's not that she comes and she decides she wants to be Jewish. Her circumstances are pushing her to be Jewish. The man brings her home. She has to shave her head. She has to either cut her nails or let them grow, according to two different opinions. She takes off her beautiful clothing that the women used to wear to entice the enemy soldiers. Puts on a plain dress. And she sits in the house of this man for 30 days and cries for her mother and father. And after that, if she decides that she does want to be Jewish, we convert her and he can marry her. If not, or if he decides that he's not interested, he can't sell her to someone else, he lets her free and that's it. That's the halacha of Eishes Yifastor. The Gemara says that this whole halacha is not a very beneficial thing. It's not good to get involved in this at all. It was only said because God knew that if the Torah would have prohibited it under the circumstances, people would live with these women anyway. And this was a way of dealing with the Yetzer Hara. Since there's a permissible way of doing it, it would give a person a chance to control himself and stop, not do it altogether. If there was no permissible way, then a person would not be able, we know what happens in wartime, a person wouldn't be able to control himself. Okay, in any case, that's the parasha, which I don't want to go into. The Zohar Chodosh says that when it says she should cry for her mother and father for 30 days, this is a hint to the month of Elul. Somehow the month of Elul has some connection to the crying of this captive woman for 30 days for her mother and her father. So what's the connection? What's the connection between the month of Elul and this whole parsha of Eishes Yifastor altogether? So one idea could be the following. The Shari Tshuva says that there are two ways of doing tshuva. In some sources it says that a person first regrets his sin and then he begins the process of tshuva. In other sources it seems to say that a person first stops doing the sin, begins the process of tshuva, and later on he regrets what he did in the past. The Shari Tshuva explains there's two different kinds of sins. A sin that you did one time, it's a quirk. It's not something that you become accustomed to. It's possible to regret it immediately, and that should be the incentive now to repent. Because you regret doing what you did. It's out of character, it's a quirk. It's not something that you've done ever before, and you really feel bad about it. So your regret will precede your initiating the tshuva process. But a sin that you've done regularly, you become accustomed and conditioned to it, you can't feel regret, it becomes almost rote. So there, the process is stop doing it, begin the tshuva process, and then as you stop doing it more and more, you'll regret having done it in the past. Okay. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Shehakol Nehiyeh Bevaro. Now, there's only one problem. What would make a person want to stop doing the sin if he doesn't regret it? So on that, there are various possible answers. And one of them is that Rosh Hashanah is coming. And you know that you're going to be judged. And you really would not like to stop doing this sin, but you really feel you have no choice, because you really believe that you're going to be judged and your entire life for the coming year hangs in the balance, and having this sin is not to your benefit. So even though you would like to continue doing the sin, you really have no choice, so you force yourself to stop, and then eventually you'll regret looking back as you get unconditioned to the sin. A similar situation would be the following. Person who is a chain smoker, loves smoking, goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, if you continue smoking, you're going to get emphysema. You are going to get this or that or whatever. Right? The person doesn't really want to stop smoking. He loves smoking, but he feels he has no choice. And eventually, if he'll quit and he'll stop, eventually he'll regret having smoked altogether, because he'll get out of the habit, and then he'll be able to look back objectively on the past. Okay. That's the case. The month of Elul has a parallel, has some connection to the idea of this woman. This woman's in a similar situation. She is a non-Jewish woman. She was not contemplating converting, marrying a Jewish man, being taken away from her parents, right, and her familiar surroundings. And all of a sudden, she's a captive in war. She's in a strange land, a strange man's house who wants to marry her. And she is compelled to convert, not because she really wants to, but because of the circumstances. And the Torah describes how one can go about making that change even though they don't really want to do it. How can you put yourself into a situation? What are the means to make a change that you don't really want to do, but you feel compelled to do? That's exactly what Elul is all about. We're all going to make changes that we may not deep down really want to do at this point. Hopefully, at some point, we will. But at this point, we feel compelled because Rosh Hashanah is coming. Same thing with this woman. She, at this point, doesn't really want to be Jewish. But because of circumstances, she's compelled to go through this process of change and conversion. And the Torah describes how we can how we can make it possible for a person who doesn't want to change to actually change. So now let's analyze the different things. First thing, the Yoshva v'Beisecha, put her into your home, change her surroundings, change her environment, give her a feeling of, wow, how nice a Jewish home is. Look what this home is all about. Right? I'm not just becoming Jewish, it's foreign to me, but I'm sitting 30 days in this man's home and observing how he observes his rituals and what he makes brachas and what he eats and what he doesn't eat and how he conducts himself. And we're talking about somebody who supposedly from. So he's going to be giving her, she's going to be exposed to a totally different environment than she was before, which will start the process of her maybe wanting to make that change, because she's inspired by the environment around her. That's the first thing. Second thing, the Gilcha Es Rosha, shave her head. The hair on the head is an extension of the head. In that respect, it's an idea of an extension of ideas, extension of a person's mind, of his intellect, is represented by the hair. That's one concept of the hair. If you want to make a change, and you really are not motivated to do it, then you have to first get back to your roots, literally. And all the preconceived ideas that you've created, all the tanglement of hair that's extended from your mind, and you've created ideas, concepts, principles, preconceived notions. Cut them away. Get back to the basics. Reassess your preconceived notions, your ideas, your beliefs. Get them back to their root and see if maybe they have to be reevaluated. Put them to the test. Go back to the root. That's one concept of shaving a hair. Second idea is that hair, especially by a woman, is a sign of her outer beauty, which is a sign of taiva, a sign of physical desire. Various drives that a person has. And therefore, same thing. Cut back, reevaluate, go back to your roots as to what you desire in this world, what is beautiful to you, what's aesthetically appealing, what is desirous, and what is not. Reevaluate your whole system of wants, desires, and what is aesthetic, what's not aesthetic, what's beautiful, what's not beautiful in your life. So another reevaluation. Right? If you're so programmed and conditioned to certain ideas and to certain desires, then you're never going to be able to change. So you have to cut back on the ideas and the desires, get back to the roots, reevaluate them, and that will make it conducive to change. Second thing, there's one opinion that says she now has to cut her nails. The other opinion says she has to let her nails grow. She can't cut them. Question what the Torah means, va'asasa es siparneha. Let's analyze both of them. According to the opinion that she has to cut her nails, okay, same thing. Get back to the roots of your actions in this world. The nails are an extension of your hands. The hands are representative of your actions in this world. What are you into doing? How do you relate to the physical world? Cut back to the root and analyze your relationship to the physical world. In addition, that's a symbol of kina, of jealousy. Because what a person does, right, and what other people do is where there is jealousy. So that's the second major root of sin. The first one is taiva, desire, lust. That you have to cut back the root by cutting the hair. And jealousy, cut down to the root by cutting the nails. And reevaluate your connection to the physical world vis-a-vis what you are involved in, what you produce, what you make, what you earn, how you earn it. Right, and then it'd be conducive maybe to make changes. But if you're conditioned in a certain way of relating to the physical world, right, with all that that entails, including jealousy, then it's going to be very hard to change your whole the whole situation. According to the opinion that says you have to let your nails grow, right? So here maybe the idea is the following: the reason that we look at our fingernails on Motzoi Shabbos. One of the reasons is that when Adam HaRishon was in Gan Eden, he didn't have clothing, him and Chava, but they were clothed with a covering of fingernail. In other words, they had a shell that encrusted their entire body. That's how people were in Gan Eden. And when they sinned, that protective covering went away, and it remained only by the nails, feet and hands, as a reminder of what was when in Gan Eden. So Motzei Shabbos is the time that Adam HaRishon was finally thrown out of Gan Eden after the sin, and we look at our fingernails to remind us that this is what's left from that protective covering that we had when we were in Gan Eden. That's why it says that a person should not discard his fingernails when he cuts them in a place where people could walk over them, because they're very dangerous, especially for a pregnant woman. A pregnant woman would walk on the fingernails. The simple idea is she got disgusted and she's in a very precarious position, and she could have a miscarriage because she'll become disgusted by walking over somebody's fingernails. but even more so since Chava was the one who initiated the sin in Gan Eden, and she lost for man and woman that protective covering, fingernails are a negative, condemning thing against women. So a woman is in a dangerous situation where she's pregnant, shouldn't walk over fingernails. So in any case, the point I'm trying to bring out is that the fingernails are a sign of remembering what it was like in Gan Eden. So a person now has to take his 10 fingers, his hand, handiwork, and let it grow. Let the fingernails grow to know that what you do in this world is for the sake of Gan Eden. It's for the sake of the world to come. There's an extension to this world. You're not just doing it for the sake of this world. Take in consideration what the goal is, what the implications are eternally. So you let the fingernails grow as an extension to the hand to show that the physical world represented by the 10 fingers needs to be extended into a spiritual world that's represented by the fingernails of Gan Eden. Okay? So that's the next step. Then, next step. The Heshira Simla Shivya. Take off her beautiful clothing and give her plain clothing. Same thing. Clothing represents one of two things. Either represents covet, the honor of a person is represented by his clothing. People wear clothing that represent their station in life, their position, their occupation. Doctor wears a doctor's coat, and a lawyer in some places wears a wig or whatever. People wear what represents their honor. Clothing is called mechabdusi, that which honors me. And a person has to cut back on his honor. This is third root of sin. Taiva, the hair, and kina, the fingernails, and now the clothing. Get back to the basics when it comes to honor and covet. Maybe you're too wrapped up in this thing in the wrong way, and therefore you can't change. So reevaluate, analyze, reassess, get back to the basics. Take off that clothing. Now clothing, yes.
Can you just read the
passage in Hebrew? Yeah, the Heshira Simlas Shivya Me'oleha. However, the clothing has another hint to it. Clothing is a hint to midos. Character traits are also referred to as the clothing that clothes a person, clothes himself with his character traits. So a person has to reassess his character, his personality traits. Because if you're ingrained in them and you think that this is the right way and you don't reassess them and you don't go back to basics, you'll never be able to change. So you have to reassess your character traits, your personality traits, and see maybe they need redirection. That's another way to help to compel a change. And lastly, Ubachsa esovia ve'esima yerach yomin. She should cry for her mother and father for a month of days. Yerach yomim. Rav Sham Shimon Frohl Hirsch says the word yerach, yoreach, has the idea of impact. It represents the impact that the moon has on time, especially on women. Right? The moon has a cyclical effect. Right, which affects women even more than men. And therefore, the 30-day period is a period where time will have an impact. And all of the changes of the moon, which we know physical changes, tides and various things that change in a 30-day cycle, 30-day cycles. So, for the impact of 30 days, take that impact of time, and let her cry her eyes out for her, for her parents. Now that impact of time has to do with the moon, because the moon has ups and downs. She goes through a whole cycle of time, exposed to this new environment, and with this new program of reevaluation. Now, what is she crying for her parents? So the Rishonim say a few different reasons what it means we let her cry for her parents. One is that kibud av va'em. She should appreciate, people appreciate their parents more when they're not around, when they don't have them. So give her a chance, out of honor for her parents, to cry for them. They may be dead. She may never see them again. Give her a chance to honor her parents. That represents the fact that sometimes things you take for granted need to be reassessed and reevaluated and valued. Things that really are valuable, but you got so used to them, you don't evaluate them. You don't value them. So during the month of Elul, a person has to reassess his values and what's important, what's not important. That's one idea. Second idea is, Abba v'Ima doesn't mean her physical parents, it means her idolatry. Let her cry for her idolatry. Now what does that mean, cry for the idolatry? When you cry, you realize that something is lost and it's not going to come back. Meaning, I put my trust in this idolatry and now I see it didn't help me. I'm a captive woman in a strange land, right? A candidate for compelled conversion, and where's my idols? Right? I put my trust in these things and I see now that I maybe shouldn't have trusted in them. Maybe they are what's it called, not worth anything. And I cry over them. When you have a loss, I see that they're a loss, that they're not something I should have trusted in. Yeah.
I have an interesting sentence here. It says,
yeah,
Isha Yifas Torah should cry for 30 days, but the Ipek of time and the cycles of time.
If what?
I wrote down, yeah. Shabbat Torah should cry for 30 days.
Right.
And what we want to say about that is, let the impact of time and
the impact of time.
Do what?
Give her a chance to make a change in her life. In other words, each 30-day period is also going to be a cause of perhaps enabling her to make this change. Another thing that's represented is her relationships with other people, right? Her relationships with her parents, right? Her past relationships with her friends, whatever, all represented by crying for her mother and her father. So it represents recognizing the importance of things that you didn't recognize on one side, and perhaps things that you trusted in and thought were important, you see now you couldn't trust in them, they weren't important at all. So you cry over the fact that these things let you down. The things that you trusted in, the things that you thought were important, are really not important and let you down. So it's both sides of the coin. And after all of this, okay, then it's possible this woman can make this monumental change in her life and become Jewish, and then this man can marry her. Now let's that's why it says after that, V'yakar kein tovoi leo ba'alto, after that you can live with her as husband and wife, right? And there'll be that connection between this man and this woman, which 30 days earlier couldn't have been because she was a totally different person. But she did use these 30 days to become the kind of person who can now have a connection and have a relationship with this Jewish man. That's what Elul is all about. Anila Dodi V'Dodi Li. We want to come on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Aseres Yemei Tshuva to have that close relationship with God. But we're really not prepared for it. We've gone through a whole year where we're not ready to have a marriage with God. Right? We are not the Jewish woman or man that can have that relationship yet. So you need to go through a change. And the change is not totally voluntary, it's more compelled. So we need the impact of 30 days to be able to do the things that would help to generate that change. And translated into the allegory, they are the following. First, change your surroundings. Put yourself in a more positive, productive environment where you'll be surrounded by the things that you want to change too. And take yourself out of the environment that's not conducive, that's detrimental to that change. First thing. Secondly, go back to your roots. In making an assessment and an appraisal of your desires, of your ideas, preconceived notions, ideas that you formulated in the past, your actions, your connection to the physical world, including jealousy of other people, your midos, and your covet, and your honor, the three roots of sin. And separate yourself, cry your eyes out, in when a person cries, they basically have come to closure. The things that I trusted in that I shouldn't have trusted, that I see will not help me. My avodah zarah, this woman's crying for. Her parents, in one respect, cry, make closure, forget about the things of the past that obviously didn't help you. On the other side, cry for your parents and realize how important they were to you. The things that are important, realize their importance more because you get used to them and you forget how important they are. Both sides of the coin. Cry and make closure for the things that you want to separate from or have to separate from. And cry and appreciate the things that you didn't appreciate before that should be appreciated. And this all takes place in a period of 30 days, because 30 days is the impact of time with all of the powers of the moon. Now the moon also represents the Jewish people, because we also have our ups and our downs, and we also in this world are very small. It's only in the next world that we'll be big. And that's why the Jewish people compared to the moon, that's why our calendar is basically a lunar calendar. And as the moon represents the power of renewal. The moon can wane, but it comes back. There's a power of chiddush, there's a power of renewal by the moon. So the 30-day period represents the fact that the Jewish people can renew themselves. And if you get into a rut, you can get out of it. But you have to be able to go through all of these motions to be able to compel yourself to make a change. So that is the connection, or at least one connection. I have a few others, but for this year, that's one. The connection between the crying for 30 days of this captive woman and the month of Elul. The connection being, the captive woman is going through a change that is not necessarily desired by her, but she feels compelled to do. And we want to put her in a situation where that compelling situation will lead her to the right desire. And that's what we want also. We're compelled to change before Rosh Hashanah. We never not want to. But if you go through this procedure for the 30 days before, by the time Rosh Hashanah comes, you may want to make that change, not just be compelled to do it. Okay, now, any questions?
When you're talking about Adam and Chava and them, it really sounds disgusting.
What, that they were like turtles?
Like, I don't get that.
I don't know if it was exactly what we have, the physical nails now. But it was like a protective covering that they had. In other words, instead of just all over the body, instead of just skin, it wasn't like they were in a case.
But they weren't naked. That was the point.
They were, but they weren't. In other words, their bodies, if a person's covered by skin, he's also naked.
Right.
He has nothing, but he has nothing beside his body. But his body contained not just skin, but a much more substantial, and it was more spiritual too. It says in the beginning, it was or, not just or, iron is skin. Or with an aleph is light. The skin there was more than just a physical covering to encase the body. It was encased in a certain casing of light. But we have a remnant of that is what we look as fingernails. But that's not what exactly was in Gan Eden. In Gan Eden it was a much more quasi-physical, spiritual covering of a person. Right, metaphysical.
Metaphysical covering.
Right, metaphysical covering. Right. Yes.
How did the cutting of the nails, the growing of the nails connect to the kinah?
Because the nails are the extension of a person's hands, handiwork, how you relate to the world. And that there are three roots of sin. Taiva, which is more connected to the hair, right? Beauty, whatever. The covet, related to your clothing. And kina is related to how you relate to the world, what you want, what other people have, or whatever, what you can put your hands on, or what other people put their hands on. So in that respect, it's connected to kina. Yes?
How do we reconcile the idea that when you have something that's a hair, so you turn them away, and then they have to have such a need to become Jew that it kind of overrides this idea that we don't try to become people.
Right, 100%.
And so this woman...
This is the exception to the case.
Right, I understand it's an exception, but...
Because the purpose over here is not so much for her, It's in order to deal with this person's yetzer hara and to give an outlet. So what normally happens in war won't happen by Jewish soldiers.
Right. So she, in essence, in this situation,
we're hoping that the person, right?
She'll want to be a Jew.
Right. And we're also hoping that this man, after having to go through his whole process, he'll the following. When you know you can't do something in a permissible way,
right,
then it's hard to go against the Yetzer Hara. But if you tell the Yetzer Hara, look, just give me another 30 days and then we'll be able to do this permissible, so he can hold himself back. And we're hoping that by the time the process plays itself out, he'll forget about the whole thing.
Send her
home and say, if you ever want to be a Gioris, do it on your own. You don't need this process. You don't need me to compel you.
Or
Taka she'll really want, and then Taka she'll be, what's it called? They'll be very nice. Another really good Jewish soul.
But there's a chance that she just might not have it in
right.
her
right,
she
exactly.
might say, I'll be
right.
not really
right,
much.
Exactly. Right.
And that's not.
In the end, no, in the end, it could be that if she really doesn't want at all, that he can't force her. And she just has to let her go. Finish. Yeah.
This never happened. No.
Yes and no. It seems from the Gemara that it did happen because David HaMelech married an Eishes Yifas Toar, who from that came either Avshalom or Amnon. Because Gemara says that if it happens, usually it's going to end up bad. You're not going to like the woman in the end, and you're going to have a son from her that's a Ben Soru Mora. It's not going to come. The Gemara says that it's what the concept is. That better to eat something that's rotten but kosher than something that's rotten that's straight. But it's rotten either way. This is not a good thing. But the Torah said better we should find a way that it should be kosher and rotten than non-kosher and rotten. Because the Torah knew, there's an extra lesson here from Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky's wife. She's the one who said this idea. She said, you see from here, the Torah knew, God created us, so he knows what we are capable of not. He knew in the circumstances of a war, if you tell a man, right, you captured this woman and you can't live with her, that's it, finished, then he's not going to be able to control himself. You tell him there's a process, then maybe in the end he'll be able to control himself and just hold himself off. Therefore, what do we see here? The Torah permitted something because God knew we couldn't do it. We couldn't handle it. That means wherever the Torah says that you can handle it, then you can. Everything the Torah says you can do means you could do it. Because if you couldn't do it, God wouldn't have prohibited it. Anything that's prohibited means it's possible to do. It's not something beyond human capability. Because where it is, God permitted it. That was her insight. Okay, have a good shot. Yes? Is it proper regularly? There are Hasidim who hold that that is a proper thing because of mikveh considerations, that the hair should be completely under or whatever, and that also that your hair should be not visible. Most opinions hold, unless you have that minute, that it's not proper for a woman to shave her head, because the Gemara says there's nothing more ugly than a bald woman.
And it says there's nothing more ugly than a bald woman. I have pictures of myself bald and I look very good.
Okay, don't show them to me.
Okay.
If you look very good, in any case, it's not. Again, you can get used to anything, and in different societies, things can be. But usually, right? Usually, the hair of a woman is something that is her beauty. It's part of her beauty, and therefore, a woman should not shave her head if her husband doesn't have the custom of this chasidus, and a woman shouldn't be forced to shave her head. She can cover her hair, but in private, there's no reason why she can't have her own hair. What's it called? If you don't have this minig, if you have this minig, it's one thing. If you don't have that minig, somebody doesn't have that minig, there's no reason to force a woman to have to shave her hair if that's not the minig, what's it called, of the place, or the minig of that person, that family. And not only that, a woman on her own should not do it because it's not proper to make her husband suffer if it's not necessary minig wise.
Okay.
There is such a custom.
Wife, like, a marriage, you know,
No, the women in those places are brought up like that, and they know that that's a custom, right? I mean, just as much as a regular woman from the regular world, right, would see this guy with long earlocks or whatever, she would think in her wildest dreams, I would have nothing to do with this guy. But if you're brought up, that's the normal way, then that's the normal way a man looks. So you get used to anything.